Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome all of you here this afternoon for a wonderful tradition at the University of Chicago, the annual Nora and Edward Ryerson Lecture. There are many lecture series at the university. This lecture is made possible by a request from Trustee Edward L. Ryerson, Jr., and it's very unusual. It's unusual in the sense that the lecturer is selected by a faculty committee of the university based on the nominations from faculty colleagues from across the entire university. Being chosen as a speaker for this series is quite a remarkable statement. First of all, the faculty of the University of Chicago is comprised of so many persons doing such remarkable work across a broad spectrum of intellectual pursuits that being singled out inevitably testifies to the extraordinary importance of the speaker's work. But beyond their broad-based and deep achievements, the faculty of the University of Chicago are a group of unrelenting standards and uncompromising judgment. Thus, the Ryerson Lecturer reflects the highest aspirations and standards of the community of scholars of the University of Chicago. This year's Ryerson Lecturer, as you know, is Professor Martha Nussbaum, the Ernst Freund Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics. Martha is a 1969 graduate of New York University. Then she received her PhD in 1975 from Harvard University, an unusually good year for PhDs from Harvard University, I will say. Before coming to the University of Chicago, she served on the faculty of Harvard University and Brown University, held a position as research advisor to the World Institute for Development Economics Research in Helsinki, and was a visiting faculty member at many universities, including Oxford and Stanford. Now, Martha is both an extraordinarily original and energetic scholar and presence in the academy, and a public intellectual in the highest and best sense. The breadth of her work and the scope of her intellectual engagement are remarkable. From ancient Greek and Roman philosophy to modern moral and political philosophy, from issues of feminism around the world to matters of human development in the context of economic and political development and global justice, Martha always brings a fresh, challenging, and highly influential approach. The breadth of her work is reflected in her appointment within the University of Chicago. She's a faculty member with either a full or associated membership in the law school, the Department of Philosophy, the Department of Classics, Department of Political Science, the Divinity School, the Committee on Southern Asian Studies, and the college. From the founding of the university, William Rainey Harper, followed by many persons over the years and many of us at the university today, spoke of the wholeness of the university, of it being one. And there's no person who embodies this ideal and this quality of the University of Chicago more than Martha Nussbaum. Martha's been a prolific writer, publishing a long list of books, essays, and articles that have simultaneously gathered great recognition in the academy and have captured the public attention by bringing imagination and academic rigor to a set of issues that resonate powerfully within and beyond the academy. Her books include The Fragility of Goodness, The Theory of Desire, Cultivating Humanity, Sex and Social Justice, Hiding from Humanity, and numerous more. Her most recent book is Liberty of Conscience, in defense of America's tradition of religious equality, which will connect to the topic of her lecture today. Her books have won a wide array of awards, which I won't list. She's been a leader in numerous scholarly and international organizations. She's been awarded 32 honorary degrees by university and colleges around the world. As you can gather from this very abbreviated description, Martha is a unique phenomenon. Those who know her appreciate how the energy behind all her very visible accomplishments is reflected in the energy that she brings to engagement and discourse with colleagues and students and her commitment to the ideal of the University of Chicago. It is therefore most fitting that the faculty of the university have chosen Martha Nussbaum as a reflection of their highest aspirations and to follow others before her as she presents the 2008 Ryerson Lecture. Her topic today is equal respect for conscience, the roots of a moral and legal tradition. So it is both my great pleasure as a president and personally to present you the 2008 Ryerson Lecture, Martha Nussbaum.
Thank you very much, Bob. And I want to thank everyone who invited me to give this lectureship. It's a great honor to do it. And so I'm looking forward to hearing from all of you in the question period. I'm going to focus on the part of this project of mine that's about Roger Williams, and I'll tell you something about why when I get to that point. So I want to start by setting the stage by reading you two short quotations from Roger Williams. The first is from the opening of his great book, The Bloody Tenet of Persecution, published in 1644. Sixthly, it is the will and command of God that since the coming of his Son, the Lord Jesus, a permission of the most paganish, Jewish, Turkish, or anti-Christian consciences and worships be granted to all men in all nations and countries. The second is from a letter he wrote toward the end of his life in 1670 to the governors of Massachusetts and Connecticut, who, unlike Rhode Island, had official established churches. He says, "Yourselves pretend liberty of conscience, but alas, it is but self, the great God self, only to yourselves." Life was tough for the settlers of 17th century New England. They responded to hardship by trying to gain God's favor for their colonies, which required, as they saw it, establishing and sternly enforcing a religious orthodoxy. By punishing or banishing those who disobeyed in word or deed, they hoped to cast impurity from their common life. The idea that a good community would be one that allowed all people to seek God in their own way took root only gradually and with great struggle. So this lecture traces that struggle, focusing on the life and ideas of Roger Williams, founder of the colony of Rhode Island, and seminal philosophical thinker about religious liberty and fairness, whose ideas shaped our ethical and legal traditions. Three aspects of Williams's thought deserve our attention. First, he develops a distinctive and highly emotional view of conscience as a seat of emotion, imagination, and ethical choice through which each person seeks meaning in his or her own way. Conscience is the source of our equality, and it is worthy of equal respect wherever it is found. Political principles, he argues, must be based on that equal respect. Second, he argues that equal respect for conscience entails protecting an extensive sphere of freedom around the individual, and that this protection must be impartial, imposing no orthodoxy. To impose orthodoxy upon the striving conscience is nothing less than what Williams, in a memorable and repeated image, calls soul rape. Third, Williams then argues that a civil peace among people who differ in religion requires a moral consensus that is itself impartial, giving the ascendancy to no creed more than any other. Such a consensus is available because there's a part of the moral sphere that we can share while differing in ultimate religious commitments. Williams dramatizes this idea from the start by making his major work a dialogue between two friends called Truth and Peace, in which Truth acknowledges the importance of reaching an accommodation that's ethically grounded for political purposes with people whom one believes to be in error. I've chosen to focus on Roger Williams today, both because his ideas played a formative role in our ethical and legal traditions, and also because I believe them to be of great importance to contemplate today as we face related problems of religious tension, both in our own nation and in the larger world around us. If we think through his ideas, we learn not only where we have come from, but also something about where we might go. Throughout my career, I've turned to major texts in the history of philosophy in this way, both as sources of illumination about history, and often at least as sources of ethical and political illumination. When we wrestle with difficult problems, we need conversation partners who are complex and deep. Wrestling with ideas from the past is often more fruitful in that way than reading journal articles written yesterday. This lecture is atypical of me only in that most of the conversations that inform my work in political philosophy have been with ancient Greek and Roman texts. Such ancient ideas, however, will end up playing a role here, since Stoicism was a major source for Williams, who began his career as a budding classical scholar. So section one is called "This Wild and Howling Land." That's a quote from a Williams letter. Life in New England was fragile and exposed. The wind, the seas, the forests, the deep snows, all of this was very strange to people accustomed to life in England, whether urban or rural. But oh, poor dust and ashes, Williams wrote of himself and his fellows, like stones once rolling down the Alps, like the Indian canoes or English boats loose and adrift. Where stop we until infinite mercy stop us? In his remarkable book, Key into the Language of America, a study of Native American life and languages, Williams ponders the Indian's ability to coexist with impermanence and constant vulnerability in what he calls this wild and howling land. Astonishingly, he says, the Indians don't mind picking up and moving on to a new place whenever climate or insects or inclination moves them. Quote, I once in travel lodged at a house at which in my return I hoped to have lodged again there the next night, but the house was gone in that interim, and I was glad to lodge under a tree. The Europeans of Massachusetts reacted to insecurity by enforcing orthodoxy of religious belief and practice. John Cotton, pastor of the First Church of Boston, one of Massachusetts's most influential religious leaders, and Roger Williams' lifelong intellectual adversary, wrote copiously in defense of religious persecution, arguing that it was necessary for civil order. It was also God's will, he said, in order to separate the diseased element of society from the healthy element. Heretics and dissidents are like Satan in our midst. Even if they behave peaceably, they're enticements to sin. He urged imprisonment, banishment, and other harsh penalties for the unorthodox. Such reactions to insecurity are sadly familiar in America's history. In situations of uncertainty, we're all too ready to project the causes of instability onto other people, grabbing hold of John Cotton's seductive metaphor of a stain in our midst that must be removed if we are to resist corruption. What makes Roger Williams of particular interest today is not just the high quality of his philosophical work, it's also the way in which he offers an attractive alternative to the paranoid response to insecurity, urging on his readers attitudes of mercy, gentleness, reasonableness, and civility, words all of which recur with obsessive frequency throughout the two great philosophical treatises that are his major works. Second section, Williams's Rhode Island. So my aim here is to study Williams's ideas, but since he was a political leader as well as a thinker, his work must be assessed in the context of his career. Williams was born in England in 1603 to a prosperous merchant family. He grew up in London near the Smithfield Plain, where religious dissenters were sometimes burnt at the stake. As a young man, he attracted the attention of the eminent jurist Lord Coke, Chief Justice of the King's Bench. Coke then arranged for the young man's education at Sutton's Hospital, the future Charterhouse School, and then after that at Pembroke College in Cambridge University, where Williams received his AB in 1627, after a classical education that focused on natural law theories based on ancient Greek and Roman Stoicism, which suffused Cook's work and which were much in vogue at the time. Williams quickly impressed by his remarkable flair for languages, mastering Latin, Greek, Hebrew, French, and Dutch. In fact, it was in this way that he made John Milton's friendship, teaching Milton Dutch in return for receiving Hebrew lessons from Milton. On graduation, Williams took orders in the Church of England, and in 1629, he accepted a chaplaincy at Oates in Essex, the manor house of Sir William Masham, grandfather of the Sir Francis Masham, who was Locke's patron at Oates in the 1690s. In 1630, a leading Puritan reformer was placed in the pillory. One of his ears was cut off, one side of his nose was split, and he was branded on the face with the letters SS, meaning sower of sedition. Later, the other side of his nose was split and his other ear was cut off, and for good measure, the man was then imprisoned for the rest of his life. Williams, who witnessed these events, and who was already very critical of the Anglican establishment, decided that he could not remain in England, and he set sail for North America. At first, Williams was warmly welcomed by the leaders of Massachusetts Bay Colony. Although Boston found his ideas about the individual conscience too radical, he was welcomed by the congregation at Salem. But he soon published a pamphlet attacking the colonists' claims to the Indians' property. He wrote sarcastically, and he added a comment, quote, Christian kings, so-called, are invested with right by virtue of their Christianity to take and give away the lands and countries of other men, end quote. The officials of Massachusetts Bay then hauled him into court, but took no action when Williams agreed to withdraw the pamphlet. He continued, however, to teach orally the falsity of the colonists' property claim. He also urged resistance to a proposed loyalty oath to be taken by all colonists. During this period, Williams spent some peaceful months at Plymouth, where he pursued his study of Indian life and languages. By 1635 and 6, the authorities saw that Williams was bent on continuing his divisive teaching. They ordered his arrest. Tipped off in advance, he fled. Looking back on the incident from Providence in 1670, he describes it this way: "I was unkindly and unchristianly, as I believe, driven from my house and land and wife and children in the midst of New England winter now about 35 years past. I steered my course from Salem, though in winter snow, which I feel yet, until these parts, wherein I may say, as Jacob Peniel, that is, I have seen the face of God." In keeping with his sense of deliverance, Williams called the newfound settlement Providence. A key part of the new settlement was respectful friendship with the Indians. Williams had always treated them like human beings, not beasts or devils. He respected their dignity. When the great Narragansett chief Canonicus, who spoke no English, broke a stick 10 times to demonstrate 10 instances of broken English promises, Williams understood his meaning and took his side. When the colonists then objected that the Indians couldn't own land because they were nomadic, Williams described their regular seasonal hunting practices, arguing that these practices were sufficient to establish a property claim, a legal argument that strikingly anticipates very recent litigation over Aboriginal land claims in Australia. Linguist that he was, he reports having at this period, quote, "a constant zealous desire to dive into the natives' language," end quote. And he learned several of the languages by actually living with the Indians for long periods of time. When Williams arrived later as a refugee then, his dealings with the Indians had long prepared the way for a fruitful relationship. Chiefs Massasoit and Canonicus welcomed him like an old friend because he had befriended them before he needed them, and he continued to do so. One of the key provisions of the Charter of Rhode Island was, quote, "it shall not be lawful to or for the rest of the colonies to invade or molest the native Indians," a provision that Williams particularly sought from the Crown and, when granted, applauded, noting that hostility to the Indians, quote, "hath hitherto been practiced to our continual and very great grievance and disturbance," end quote. Throughout his life, Williams continued these friendships. As he wrote to the governor of Massachusetts, explaining his refusal to return, quote, "I feel safer down here among the Christian savages along Narragansett Bay than I do among the savage Christians of Massachusetts Bay." Now, Williams wasn't talking about conversion. He, in fact, never tried to convert the Indians. He was talking about moral decency. He's fond of noting examples of Indian decency and honesty, contrasting their behavior with that of his white neighbors. This experience of finding integrity and goodness outside the parameters of orthodoxy surely shaped his evolving views of political principles. And there was already something antinomian about Williams, something that led him to those friendships in the first place, a respectful curiosity about the varieties of humanity. That's the paradigm of something valuable in our history as a nation of strangers and immigrants, though that value is now under great stress. Williams immediately provided for religious liberty in the new colony. Rhode Island soon became a haven for people who were in trouble elsewhere. Baptists, Quakers, and other dissidents soon joined the Puritan dissenters. In 1658, 15 Portuguese Jewish families arrived in Newport. They enjoyed the same religious liberty granted others, an astonishing fact given that Jews in Britain gained full civil rights only in 1858. In 1643, William set sail for England to secure a charter for the new colony. During the sea voyage, he wrote his book about Indian language, and while in England, he wrote The Bloody Tenet of Persecution. A democratic charter was obtained and liberty of conscience made official. In 1652, Rhode Island passed the first law in North America making slavery illegal. Meanwhile, John Cotton's angry reply to The Bloody Tenant, published in 1647, led Williams to produce another work about 100 pages longer than the first one, which is already about 400 pages long, refuting all of Cotton's arguments. Published in 1652 in London, it bears the unwieldy title, The Bloody Tenant, Yet More Bloody, by Mr. Cotton's Endeavor to Wash It White in the Blood of the Lamb, of whose precious blood, spilt in the blood of his servants, and of the blood of millions spilt in former and later wars for conscience's sake, that most bloody tenet of persecution for cause of conscience, upon a second trial, is now found more apparently and more notoriously guilty. That's really there. The Civil Wars and the Restoration made it necessary to renegotiate the charter, and Williams again went to England and found in Charles II a ready ally for his experiment in religious liberty. The Barbados had already permitted religious liberty, but by omission and policy rather than by explicit written guarantee. Rhode Island, however, was the first case of an official written policy of religious liberty, and Williams writes with amusement of how shocked the king's ministers were by the charter. But, quote, fearing the lion's roaring, they couched against their wills in obedience to his majesty's pleasure, end quote. The charter was shocking indeed, not only in its odd provision regarding the Indians, but above all in its clause regarding religious liberty, which goes like this. No person within the said colony at any time hereafter shall be in any wise molested, punished, disquieted, or called in question for any differences in opinion in matters of religion, and do not actually disturb the civil peace of said colony, but that all and every person and persons may from time to time and at all times hereafter freely and fully have and enjoy his and their own judgments and consciences in matters of religious concernments throughout the tract of land hereafter mentioned, they behaving themselves peaceably and gently, not using this liberty to licentiousness or profaneness, nor to the civil injury or outward disturbance of others. Any law, statute, or clause therein contained, or to be contained, usage or custom of this realm, to the contrary hereof, in any wise notwithstanding. Okay, so what does the clause protect? Belief and the expression of opinion in religious matters, clearly. But Williams, throughout his writings, was very careful to insist that acts of worship should also enjoy protection. In fact, in his own writings, we rarely encounter the word belief without also finding the word worship or practice. He introduces the bloody tenet with the announcement that consciences and worships are all to be permitted. Elsewhere, he uses phrases such as, for either professing doctrine or practicing worship, doctrine or practice, holdeth or practiseth, and so on. It's a bit unfortunate that the charter is less precise, but we can understand the latitude of its protection from the other direction as stopping where civil disturbance begins. Williams was no John Stuart Mill. He thought that the business of civil government included not only protection of individuals from harm to their rights by others, but also the maintenance of public order and public morality. Thus, like virtually everyone at the time, he favored laws against adultery and other so-called morals laws. Not, however, on religious grounds. His idea of public morality keeps it deliberately quite distinct from religious norms and justifications. The final provision in the Charter is very interesting. The Charter guarantees liberty of religious belief and practice, even when a law or custom forbids it. In other words, if law says that you have to swear an oath before God to hold public office, this law is nullified by the Charter. Moreover, it appears that the Charter nullifies the applicability of laws to individuals when such laws threaten their religious liberty. If a law says that people have to testify on Saturday and your religion forbids this, then that law is non-applicable in your case. In other words, it would appear that Williams has forged the legal concept of accommodation on grounds of conscience. Laws of general applicability have force only up to the point where they threaten religious liberty and public order and safety are not at stake. This policy was stated explicitly by Williams in a later letter. Comparing the colony to a ship at sea on which Christians, Jews, pagans, and Muslims have all embarked, he says that the captain of that ship is entitled to require anything that's connected to the ship's safety and that of its passengers, but otherwise there is to be the widest possible religious liberty alike for all passengers. Next section, this conscience is found in all mankind, Williams's defense of religious liberty. Behind this important political achievement is a body of thought as rich on these issues as that of John Locke, and considerably more perceptive concerning the psychology of both persecutor and victim. At its heart is an idea or image on which Williams focused with deep emotion and obsessional zeal, the idea of the preciousness and dignity of the individual human conscience. Conscience, for Williams, plays the role that the directive faculty of moral choice played in the ancient Stoic authors whom he studied. It is basically a faculty of searching and choosing, although for Williams it includes imagination and emotion as well as ethical reasoning. It is, Williams holds, the main source of our identity as agents. He says it is indeed the man. Williams has his own intense religious beliefs, and they entail that most people around him are wrong. Error, however, does not mean that they don't have the precious faculty of conscience. Quote, this conscience is found in all mankind, in Jews, Turks, Papists, Protestants, pagans, etc. And although truth is important, truth is not the basis of respect. What Williams reveres is the faculty itself, the capacity for searching and choosing. Like the ancient Stoics, he holds that this faculty exists in people of all religions. He's fond of lists and usually includes Jews, Muslims, Catholics, pagans, prominently including the Indians, and even atheists, whom he calls anti-Christians. He insists that all consciences deserve not only respect, but equal respect. So, everyone has inside him or herself something infinitely precious, something that demands respect from us all, and something in regard to which we are all basically equal. Williams now argues that this precious something needs extensive space to unfold itself and to pursue its own way. To respect human beings is, therefore, to accord that sort of space to each and every one of them. He expresses indignation that someone, quote, that speaks so tenderly for his own, hath yet so little respect, mercy, or pity to the like conscientious persuasions of other men. Are all the thousands of millions of consciences at home and abroad fuel only for a prison, for a whip, for a stake, for a gallows? Are no consciences to breathe the air but such as suit and sample his? These images are revealing. They tell us that Williams thinks of consciences as delicate, vulnerable, living things, things that need to breathe and not to be imprisoned. Here, to my mind, Williams makes decisive progress beyond the stoicism of his classical education. Stoic thinkers treat the moral faculties of a person as invulnerable, rock hard. They can't be damaged by worldly conditions. A slave, they say, is not less free internally for being a slave. So it would appear external coercion is not all that important. Stoics, therefore, have difficulty drawing political conclusions from their arguments about human dignity. Williams, by contrast, sees that the conscience is not invulnerable. It can be prevented from acting, and it can also, more deeply, be damaged or defiled by what happens to it. This insight is necessary, I think, for a workable doctrine of political liberty. Williams has the keenest sensitivity to any damage to this precious thing, comparing persecution repeatedly to soul rape. And it is soul rape, he says, when any person is limited with respect to either belief or practice so long as he is not violating civil laws or harming others. Quote, I acknowledge that to molest any person, Jew or Gentile, for either professing doctrine or practicing worship, it is to persecute him. And such a person, whatever his doctrine or practice be true or false, suffereth persecution for conscience, end quote. To be more precise, Williams has two distinct images for persecution, rape and imprisonment, corresponding to different types of damage to the conscience. Persecution is like imprisonment in that people whose faculty of conscience is undamaged still need breathing space to act on their conscience's promptings, searching for meaning through whatever forms of prayer, worship, or speech they select. But persecution is also like rape. It goes into a person's depths and does terrible damage. Williams thinks that being forced to affirm what you don't believe can harm the soul in its very capacity to strive, deforming and weakening it, though it never destroys the basis of equal respect because it never extinguishes the capacity for striving. So what's needed is first protection for consciences so they can grow undefiled, and second, protection of a space around the conscience so it can venture out into the world and conduct its search. Persecution is therefore a terrible error, one of the worst there can ever be. Williams explicitly says that it's a worse error than being a heretic, and in fact, persecution is a doctrine, quote, which no uncleanness, no adultery, incest, sodomy, or bestiality can equal. This ravaging and forcing, explicitly or implicitly, the very souls and consciences of all the nations and inhabitants of the world, end quote. Williams doesn't believe that the offenses to which he compares persecution are trivial. Indeed, he's inclined to favor the death penalty for adultery. So we can see how strong his objection to persecution is, if it's worse than those things. Most rulers in all ages, he concludes, have practiced violence to the souls of men. Now, one of Williams's reasons for hating persecution is instrumental. If you force someone, it hardens their opposition, preventing their voluntary conversion. He makes this point often when he's in ad hominem debate with John Cotton, and it was a common Protestant argument, one that Locke later makes central. One can't read Williams, however, and doubt that he also thinks damage to conscience an intrinsic wrong, a desecration of what is most precious about the human being. Williams has insisted that this precious something is in us all and is worthy of equal respect. Therefore, it's a heinous wrong to give it freedom for some and then to deny this same freedom to others. Again and again, he hammers home the charge of partiality and unfairness. Magistrates, he says, give liberty with a partial hand and unequal balance. How, quote, will this appear to be equal in the very idea of common peace and righteousness, end quote. And his own marginal summaries of his argument in the book, particularly in the later work, keep recurring to this theme, saying things like unchristian partiality, gross partiality to private interests, gross partiality, the bloody tenet of persecution. Williams, therefore, has a keen nose for special pleading and unfairness, and he sees it everywhere restrictions on religious liberty are found. He suggests that the error of the persecutor is a kind of anxiety-ridden greed, which is hypocritically disguised as virtue. Each person, anxious and insecure, aims to carve out special protections and privileges for himself by attacking in others what he values most in his own life. In his letter to the governors of Massachusetts and Connecticut that I read earlier, he indicts them for a hypocritical and unfair set of principles, for worshiping, in effect, only the great God self. If persecution is the worst of errors, liberty of conscience is, Williams repeatedly states, a most precious and invaluable jewel. The proponent of liberty does not engage in special pleading. Even though he believes he's right, he has an even-handed spirit of love and civility to all men, grounded in respect for their freedom. In one remarkable passage, Williams states that persecution is not only, quote, to take the being of Christianity out of the world, but to take away all civility and the world out of the world, and to lay all upon heaps of confusion. What does he mean by saying that persecution takes the world out of the world? I think he's expressing the view that the spirit of love and gentleness, combined with the spirit of fair play, are at the heart of our worldly lives with each other. Take these things away, and you despoil the world itself. You make it nothing but a heap of confusion. Williams is, as you can see, an emotional writer. His style is deeply subjective and passionate. Nonetheless, it's not implausible to find themes in his writings that anticipate some central ideas of Immanuel Kant a century later. At the heart of the thought of both men are two ideas, the duty to respect humanity as an end wherever it is found, and the duty to be fair, not to make an exception for one's own case. Indeed, respecting humanity entails not making an exception of oneself. Just as Kant asks a person to test the principle of his or her conduct by asking whether it could, without contradiction, be made a universal law for all human beings, so Williams's critique of the leaders of Massachusetts and Connecticut is that their idea cannot pass a test of that sort. They love freedom, but only for themselves. They could not will persecution as a universal law, and their selfishness makes them not willing to will freedom of conscience, which would pass the Kantian test, as a universal law. Kant's second test for our ethical principles is one that he calls the formula of humanity. He asks us to test our principle by seeing whether it treats humanity as an end rather than a mere means. We are to ask whether we're really showing respect to human beings or whether we're just using them as objects in the pursuit of our own selfish ends. This complaint, too, is a constant theme in Williams's writing. The conscience is precious, but people use other people's consciences to serve their own anxious and greedy ends. Kant's third way of scrutinizing principles invokes the idea of autonomy. We are to ask ourselves whether we can view our principle as a law that we could give to ourselves. There's no precise echo of this in Williams, but his insistence on the quest of the individual conscience and the priceless value of freedom in this quest is in great sympathy with Kant's way of thinking. For both, the source of moral worth is ultimately in our own freedom, and that freedom must be respected. For both, doing the right thing because of obedience to a law imposed from without has no moral worth at all. Finally, Kant speaks of good principles as constituting a realm of ends, a virtual society of free beings who respect one another as equals. I believe this is basically what Williams is after when he says that persecution takes the world out of the world. It destroys the basis of human fellowship in respect, freedom, and civility. Williams, then, lies at the beginning of a tradition of thought about religious fairness that resonates to the present day in John Rawls's work on liberty and respect. And Williams has an extra measure of psychological insight, helping us see why persecution is so attractive and what emotional attitudes might be required to resist it. Next section, a model of church and civil power. If Williams had offered only an account of conscience and its fair, impartial treatment, he would already have made a large contribution to our understanding of religious liberty. He accomplished, however, much more, developing an elaborate account of the proper jurisdictions of religious and civil authority that anticipates Locke's more famous account and that still offers helpful guidance. In this part of his work, Williams is replying to a model of church and state proposed by John Cotton. Truth asks Peace, "What book do you have there?" And then Peace pulls out the Cotton manuscript, and she reads from it the claim that the church must hold high authority in the civil realm and should be superior to all civil magistrates if peace is to be preserved. The 200 pages that follow contain Williams's alternative model. According to Williams, there are two separate sorts of ends and activities in human life. Corresponding to these are two different sorts of authority. Civil authority concerns, quote, the bodies and goods of subjects, end quote. And this is exactly the characterization that Locke later gives. Civil authority must protect people's property and bodily security, and it may use force to do so. Its foundation lies in the people, and it is they who choose civil magistrates. The other sphere of life is that of the soul and its safety. Churches have this sphere as their jurisdiction, with the proviso that their only proper means of addressing the soul is persuasion. The two sorts of authority, civil and spiritual, can coexist peacefully together. Peace is in jeopardy only to the extent that churches overstep their boundaries and begin to make civil law or interfere with other people's property or liberty. Williams now tells us that there is, of course, a way in which the civil state needs to make laws respecting religion. Namely, it has to make laws protecting it, saying, for example, quote, that no persons, Papists, Jews, Turks, or Indians, be disturbed at their worship, a thing which the very Indians abhor to practice toward any, end quote. Such protective laws are not only permitted, they are also extremely important. He calls them the Magna Carta of the highest liberties. But there is, he continues, another type of law respecting religion that's very different, the sort of law that establishes or forbids acts of worship, says who can and can't be a minister, and so on. To say that these should be civil laws, quote, is as far from reason as that the commandments of Paul were civil and earthly constitutions, end quote. John Cotton, however, makes two claims that Williams must answer if he's to defend his radical position well. First, he makes a claim about peace and stability. People simply can't live at peace with one another unless some religious orthodoxy is established. In response, Williams invokes both reason and experience on his side. People with false religious views, he says, may be perfectly decent citizens. We can see this all the time. People do live together peacefully as long as they respect one another's conscience space. Life with the Indians provides a handy illustration. What really breaks the peace is persecution. Quote, such persons only break the city's or kingdom's peace who cry out for prison and swords against such who cross their judgment or practice in religion. Cotton's second argument concerns competence. He claims that being a good citizen and being a good civil magistrate are inseparable from having the right religion. We simply don't want our public life to be run by sinners, because they're making very important decisions, and if they are sinners, they will do so sinfully and badly. Here, Williams makes one of his most interesting and novel arguments. God, he says, has created different sorts of things in the world, and there are, quote, diverse sorts of goodness, end quote, corresponding to these different sorts of thing. He illustrates this point at great length, talking about the goodness of artifacts, plants, animals, and so on. But one of the ways that God creates diversity in the world is to create a type of, quote, civil or moral goodness, end quote, that is commendable and beautiful in its own right, and that is distinct from spiritual goodness. It can be there in its full form and be beautiful, even if the person is in religious error, even, quote, though godliness, which is infinitely more beautiful, be wanting, end quote. What's needed to be a good subject in a civil state is the moral sort of goodness. And it's that sort as well that we want from our civil magistrates. Later, returning to the point, he insists that the foundation of the magistrate's authority, quote, is not religious, Christian, etc., but natural, humane, and civil, end quote. For many activities in human life, he continues, a worldly foundation is all we want. Quote, a Christian captain, Christian merchant, physician, lawyer, pilot, father, master, and so consequently magistrate, etc., is no more a captain, merchant, physician, lawyer, pilot, father, master, magistrate, etc., than a captain, merchant, etc., of any other conscience or religion. You see his style and why it took him 500 pages to express this. Particularly surprising, I think, is his casual mention of father as one of the roles whose duties can be fully executed independently of spiritual enlightenment. In short, for Williams, the civil state has a moral foundation, but a moral foundation need not be and must not be a religious foundation. The necessary moral virtues, and honesty is one to which Williams devotes special emphasis, can be agreed on and practiced by people from many different religious doctrines. To be sure, he adds, a person's religion will connect these moral virtues to higher ends, but so far as the moral sphere itself goes, Orthodox and dissenter, religious and non-religious can agree. It's not fanciful to see here an adumbration of John Rawls's idea of civil society as involving a set of moral principles concerning which people from different so-called comprehensive doctrines can join in what Rawls calls an overlapping consensus. Like Williams, Rawls stresses that political society has a moral foundation, but he holds that this is a module, he calls it, that can be linked to different religious doctrines in a variety of different ways. Although religious people will certainly feel that their religion provides the moral principles with their highest ends or deepest sources, and here again he's agreeing with Williams, they can nonetheless agree about the moral terrain in a way that is, for political purposes, freestanding, that is, not requiring the acceptance of a religious orthodoxy. So, we don't have exactly a wall of separation between people's religions and their political principles. Williams used that phrase once, but uncharacteristically and only in a letter, not at all in his major writings. We do have separation of jurisdictions between church and state, but where people are concerned, they will rightly see the morality of public life as one part of their comprehensive doctrine, a part, nonetheless, that they can share with others without converting them to what they take to be the true religion. This idea, I think, is a much more helpful idea to think with than the, in some way, crude idea of separation, which might suggest that the state doesn't have anything at all to do with the deep ethical matters that are so central to the religions. The state needs to be built on moral principles, and it would be weird and tyrannical to ask religious people to accept the idea that these moral principles are utterly separate from their own religious principles. The idea of an overlapping consensus, or to put it in Williams's way, the idea of a moral and natural goodness that we can share while differing about ultimate religious ends, is an idea that helps us think about our shared life much better than the unclear idea of separation. We must respect one another's freedom and equality, the deep sources of conscience that lead us through life. We will only do this if we keep religious orthodoxy out of our common political life. But we can and must base that life on ethical principles that for many of us also have a religious meaning and a religious justification. All we need do when we join with others in a common political life is to acknowledge that someone might have those virtues in the way that's most relevant for politics while not sharing our own view of life's ultimate meaning. If we once grant that, then Williams's other argument concerning impartiality will lead us to want a state that has no religious orthodoxy, that is just in that sense separate from religion. Looking back at the history, I think we ought to agree with Williams. We should and often do separate a person's specific religion from the kind of goodness we look for in fact, a doctor, lawyer, teacher, even an adoptive parent. That we so obsessively focus on the religions of political candidates as contrasted with their moral virtues, virtues that we can all share, is a fact of American political life that we should regret and attempt to change. But we can make our account more precise now if we compare Williams's thought to that of Locke. Locke probably knew Williams's work, and he wrote his letter concerning toleration, published in 1685, at Oates in Essex, the same noble house where Williams was employed. His arguments bear a close resemblance to Williams's in the general nature of their conclusions about the role of the state and in their focus on what Locke calls equal and impartial liberty. Nonetheless, there are six significant differences, all of which I believe should make us prefer Williams's approach. First, Locke seems to think that equal liberty is compatible with a religious establishment. Williams is keenly aware of the dangers of religious establishment as threats to both liberty and equality. To liberty, because a dominant sect will easily slip into curbing the conscience space of minorities. To equality, because the very existence of an orthodoxy makes a statement that citizens are not fully equal. Here, Williams, I think, anticipates a famous argument of James Madison's. Establishment means that we don't all enter the public square on what Madison calls equal conditions. At the time of the founding, the central argument against establishments was this equality argument, and directly or not, it was Williams's argument. Second, Williams gives us, in his discussion of conscience, an account of the moral basis of the political doctrine, telling us what equal respect is all about and why it is so important. There's nothing like this in Locke, at least not in the letter. Third, Locke and Williams have subtly different positions on accommodation, that is, on the question whether laws applicable to all could and should contain exceptions for people with special religious requirements. Locke is in favor of the exceptionless rule of law, provided that the laws themselves are neutral. Some laws maliciously target minorities, and those laws must go. For example, if it's legal to speak Latin in a school, it must be legal to speak Latin in a church, he says. If it's legal to bathe in water for the sake of health or recreation, it must be legal to bathe in water for the sake of baptism. But there, Locke draws the line. If there's any non-malicious law that has the incidental effect of burdening minorities, then the person whose conscience poses an obstacle to his obeying that law had better follow conscience, says Locke, because eternal salvation is probably more important than going to jail, but he will have to go to jail or pay a fine. Williams, as we've seen, is subtly different. He allows exceptions to general laws for conscience's sake up to the point where the person's conduct would threaten peace and public safety. In so holding, he anticipates a norm that soon became general in the state constitutions by the time of the founding. They all had free exercise clauses with similar peace and safety overrides. Madison actually favored an even more protective standard. He wanted the law to say that there would be no burden to conscience unless the Constitution itself is in jeopardy. The practices of the new colonies involved granting such conscience-based exemptions without legal penalty. Jews did not usually have to testify on Saturday. Sects that objected to oaths didn't have to swear. Quakers and Mennonites were exempted from military service. Most remarkably, and only in Rhode Island, Jews were exempted from the incest law if they wanted to contract uncle-niece marriages on religious grounds. Those laws remained valid, and religious minorities just didn't have to obey them. In the early days of the Republic, George Washington wrote a letter to the Quakers explaining his stance as first president concerning their conscientious refusal of military service. He writes, "I assure you very explicitly that in my opinion, the conscientious scruples of all men should be treated with great delicacy and tenderness. And it is my wish and desire that the laws may always be as extensively accommodated to them as a due regard for the protection and essential interests of the nation may justify and permit." This is pure Williams, and it's far from what Locke's stricter notion of the rule of law would permit. The contrast between Williams and Locke is still with us in the form of divergent standards that have played a role in recent Supreme Court debates. The Williams idea was long a hallmark of free exercise jurisprudence in the form of what has come to be known as the Sherbert test, after an important 1963 case involving a woman who was fired because her Seventh-day Adventist beliefs forbade her to work on Saturday and was then denied unemployment compensation on the grounds that she had refused suitable work. The court, finding in her favor, said that government may not impose a substantial burden on a person's free exercise of religion without what they called a compelling state interest. The case had an important equality aspect. The fact that Saturday and not Sunday was the required day put unfair pressure on this minority woman, pressure that the majority did not have to face. This was our legal standard for some years, but in 1990, the Lockean position took control with Justice Scalia's controversial opinion in a case involving Native American peyote use. Scalia said that laws must rule exceptionlessly so long as they were neutral and not discriminatory. Scalia, like Locke, is very interested in legal neutrality. Thus, when a Florida community passed an ordinance forbidding ritual animal sacrifice, he was in favor of striking it down, holding that the fact that they allowed animals to be slaughtered in all sorts of other ways showed that they were discriminating. They were simply targeting the Santeria worshipers. But he doesn't believe the courts should go beyond this to insist on the protection of conscience against laws that are not hostile, although he's willing to allow legislatures to pass such laws if they want. What this conflict over accommodation is really about is the equality of minorities in a majority world. Rules about work days, drugs, and a host of other matters inevitably favor the majority. So alcohol is legal and peyote isn't, Sunday is the usual day of rest and Saturday isn't, and so on. Williams understood the vulnerability of minority conscience in a world of majority rule, and his more protective standard should, I believe, be restored. Fourth, Locke argues from Protestant premises most of the time. He seems uninterested in finding arguments for toleration that all citizens can share. Williams alludes to Christian norms at times, but he tries very hard to develop an independent ethical argument for his political principles based on the dignity and vulnerability of conscience, the equal worth of all consciences, and the need of all consciences for ample space. Williams was used to arguing with people who did not share his religious views, as Locke often wasn't. So he finds ways of arguing that don't presuppose the correctness of his position. The fifth difference between Locke and Williams lies in the way in which they conceive of the space of the political. Locke speaks in terms of separation of jurisdictions. For him, religion and politics just don't overlap at all. For Williams, the different religious doctrines meet and overlap in a shared moral space. Each religious person will connect this moral space to his own religious goals and ends, but within that space, we're all able to speak a common language and share moral principles. As I've argued, this idea of overlap is ultimately more fruitful than the idea of separation. Williams doesn't ask religious people to give up ways in which their religion links politics with faith. He simply asks people to live and talk together in the shared space without compromising equality by introducing religious doctrines into the institutions they create and sustain. Sixth and last, Locke is not distinguished as a moral psychologist, and he has just nothing to say about why people persecute others. Williams does, tracing persecution to anxious insecurity and the accompanying desire to create security by lording it over others. He has a keen sense both of the inner life of the persecutor and of the inner vulnerability of the persecuted to something that is very like rape, an inner shattering of the soul's integrity and peace. He also understands clearly how people engage in special pleading to favor their own case while appearing to defend morality itself. On balance, then, I would give Locke the prize for succinct, clear writing, but Williams the prize for philosophical insight. The last section, another quote from the work, is called Truth and Peace, Their Meetings Seldom and Short. Williams's work and career construct the basis for a politics based on equal respect for conscience. But he was too shrewd to expect that this goal would be attained easily or quickly. At the end of The Bloody Tenet, Truth and Peace remark that they don't actually spend very much time together. So often, they observe, they meet up lovingly, but then are abruptly parted by hypocrisy and selfish partiality. They have, however, a surprise ally. At the very end of the work, a third character makes her appearance. "But lo," says Peace, "who's here?" Truth replies, "Our sister, Patience, whose desired company is as needful as delightful." Patience utters not a single word, but she's clearly there. In his book on Indian languages, Williams wrote eloquently of the patience of the Indians, who can sit silently for ages waiting for what they want. Quote, "Every man hath his pipe of their tobacco, and a deep silence they make, and attention give to him that speaketh." To his impatient world, Williams commends this example. Now, at the close of his great dialogue, he represents Patience as, in effect, an Indian, silent after the prolixity of her sisters, waiting for a time that may be very long in coming, a time of equal respect for people who differ. Notice the psychological insight in Williams's choice of words, "whose desired company is both needful and delightful." For the anxious, self-focused people Williams describes, bent on control, patience may possibly be attainable, but it's a painful virtue. What the anxious person really wants is for others to do what the anxious person has already decided they should do. So waiting for them to be themselves and live the way they choose to live is stressful. To view and experience patience as not only needful, but also delightful, is the attitude of someone who actually enjoys the other person's freedom, finding lack of control over the other person's choices and actions not an inconvenience to be endured, but a source of exhilaration and even joy. Given human weakness, such an attitude, which we might aptly call political love, is a complex and delicate achievement, a virtue manifested here only in an open-ended silence. In that silence, after the close of so much speech, rests Williams's hope for the future. Now, we have, I think, about 20 minutes for questions and answers, and I want to begin by calling on some students, because it's such an important part of my work to get the criticisms of the students that I work with, and I've learned so much on this project and any other one from them. So I think I'll just look around and see who would like to go first. Daniel? Say, introduce yourself.
Hi, my name's Daniel. I'm a graduate student in the philosophy department. You want me to stand up? All right. I just wanted to invite you to say more about the relationship between conscience and truth, and in particular, about your idea that the capacity for searching, which is constitutive of conscience, has intrinsic value. And so my question, I guess, takes the form of a challenge. So from a first-person perspective, when I evaluate my own conscience, I have the intuition that it's failed me, that it's not working as it should, and maybe I'd even say it doesn't have a heck of a lot of value for me if I realize I haven't been tracking the truth, if it's failed me and my ethical principles are just off base. And so you might wonder, why should I then value someone else's conscience when I take them to be off base, assuming, let's say in this case, that I know they're off base. And you might think that acknowledgement of this sort of worry is implicit in the idea that we need an overlapping consensus that's made up of reasonable comprehensive doctrines, right? So we need a common moral base, and what makes freedom of conscience sort of such an attractive idea is that we've already built into the notion that everyone already kind of has the basics right when it comes to ethics. But that when we get rid of that idea, it seems less compelling to think that the ability to strive in and of itself has intrinsic value.
I think this is very, very hard question, and I'm not going to be able to answer it entirely here. But I guess, look, what I think is that there's a kind of tacit premise in the argument, which is that this is not an easy matter. I mean, something like Rawls's account of the burdens of judgment. That is that, you know, life is mysterious, it's very complicated, and we're all struggling to do it. If it was very, very easy to find the truth, like just learning that 2 + 2 = 4, and some people got it right and other people didn't, then it might seem that you could just feel impatient with them and think, well, then they're just broken toys, you know, they can't get it right. So I think he needs to think that it's very, very difficult to get it right, and that we probably don't even know for sure that we're right. I think he also believes that. And so that being the case, the faculty with which we engage in this difficult and delicate struggle is a very precious thing, because the task is so daunting. We have the need for a faculty that is itself very complicated and subtle. And so we all have that faculty that's complicated and subtle. And so whether the person has penetrated the fog of being or not, it's deserving of respect. Something like that, I think. Yeah, Dasha.
Hi. Thanks very much for the talk.
Name and your department.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Dasha Polzik. I'm in the philosophy department as well. So my question is something related to this faculty that we have to have. And really, I want to ask you to say something about the relationship between love and toleration. So really, my question is something like, is something as deep and, I want to say intimate, but something as engaged as love really required for citizens, for instance, in how they treat one another? So you spoke in the last paragraph of the this notion of political love. And I just wonder whether respect for conscience really demands that much of citizens, demands love as opposed to just toleration. And so I wonder what you think toleration is and why that's not sufficient.
Okay, there are really three things, not two. I think there's toleration, there's respect, and then there's love. Toleration, I think rightly, Williams and most of the American tradition rejected as too grudging and stingy. In fact, one of the things that George Washington said at some point was, it is now no more that toleration is spoke of, as if it were something like by the exercise of superior authority that others were allowed to enjoy their natural rights. So I think the Americans thought that it was a matter of right, and therefore toleration was too de haut en bas, and they didn't like that word, and they rarely used it. But then we have respect, really, in Williams, not just toleration. And respect is much more positive. It's the acknowledgement of the entitlement of all people to this space around them. But then the question is, why do we need anything more than that? Why does it need to be supported with these other psychological attitudes? Now, you know, here's something where looking at Rawls as you've done so much, I think you can sort of see that Rawls tries hard to think about political stability without these deeper psychological attitudes, and then ultimately says, really, we can't do it without something more like love. And so in the third part of Theory of Justice, he works out an account, which he then got dissatisfied with. He then withdrew it. But I think one problem with the way he did it even then is that it was too abstract and not connected to particular experiences, particular images. So right now, I should say I'm writing a book on patriotism, which is co-authored with another student who was unable to be here, unfortunately. But what we're working on is the role of these memories, symbols, songs, poetry in creating the underpinnings for a decent society. Now, of course, there are many, many ways in which those appeals to emotion could go badly wrong in political life. And I think for that reason, liberals have tried to prune that away, thinking we better try to base it on rational principles alone. But, you know, I think if you want to get people to really overcome the ills of racism, for example, you wouldn't have done it by just some million arguments. Martin Luther King Jr.'s inspiring and passionately moving rhetoric, which was full of love and appeals to love and joy in the very texture of the words, in the way you were asked to see America as a beautiful place, a place that you loved, a place that was sensuous, the curvaceous slopes of California, and all the things that he thinks up to get people interested in America. I think those appeals to passion are an essential source of political stability and of the willingness of people to sacrifice for a common end. So anyway, that's what we're going to try to say. And we're also going to try to say that it's not just kind of these serious and stirring things, but it's also jokes and humor and so on. That's what Jeff Israel is an expert in, and so he's going to write that part. But anyway, you know, these things are an important part of the texture of political life. And if you try to make people do things that are fine on the basis of high-minded principle alone, I don't think it would last very long. Okay. I think I'll open it to other... a law student. Good. Elsa Karuni.
I'm Elsa from... I'm a student at the law school. So I would like to have more precisions about the idea of protection of space around one's conscience. Because if I understood well, Williams... insist on the fact that we're agents that acts and moves, so that we deserve the protection not only of our beliefs but also of our practice and worship. And I was thinking about, like, it's a case in France where now the law forbids to wear all visible religious signs in public institutions like universities. So I was wondering if we should a distinction, not for the beliefs, but for the religious practice, we should make a distinction between the public space, well, the private space, the worship space, like churches and synagogues and mosques, and the public space, because it may be justified by the maintenance of the public order or an equality agreement, but I would like to know, what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I do have views about this. Yeah, I mean, I hesitate to say, you know, other nations should simply pick up the tradition that America has worked out over the years, because each nation has its own problems to confront and its own tradition. And obviously the problem that the French tradition has confronted so aggressively is clerical authority, and trying to push that to one side was the goal of the secular state. But, you know, still... I guess the thing is to say, well, you can do whatever you like in private, but in the public space we're going to have these rules, seems to me to be not really fair to people, because the public space is shaped by majority norms. And as I say, you got to pick some day off from work. You got to pick some drugs that'll be legal and others that will not be legal, unless you have a policy of total legalization of drugs, of course. But in general, you're going to make the choices that favor the majority, and you probably won't even notice that you're doing that. Well, once you do that, then the minority is in an unfair position. And of course, the French policy is a case of that, because Christians are not penalized by this dress code. It does forbid large Christian crosses, but Christians are not religiously required to wear large crosses, or indeed any cross. But Jewish yarmulkes and Muslim headscarves are regarded by many in those religions as religiously required. So I think it's quite an unfair policy. And I think similar things in Belgium, where, let's say, government employees in Antwerp are now, or, well, in the Netherlands this is, but also in Belgium things have happened. But in Antwerp, government employees may not wear these articles of clothing on the job. So if they want to work for the government, and of course the public sector is a very large part of the employment in those nations, then they just have to violate their religious requirement. And I think what this tradition I'm talking about says is that, number one, that violates your conscience, but number two, it does so in an unfair way, because the majority would never have made that law if they themselves would have to suffer violation of conscience for that. Alex, another law student.
I'm Alex, another law student. Williams seemed to believe that if morality is divorced from religion, then there will be agreement, but this is often not the case. So why is it not soul rape to force a person to comply with a moral judgment with which he does not agree?
Ah, that's very good. Well, you know, obviously, he himself is not guiltless along these lines, because he makes many very, what we now regard as hasty and controversial moral judgments, and he thinks of them as part of public reason rather than expressing a particularistic idea that we might want to watch out for, such as the harsh laws against adultery and sodomy and so on. So I think we should always be skeptical about moral judgments that impinge on someone else's comprehensive doctrine, in Rawls's sense, their sense of what has most meaning in life, what is most worth pursuing. And with regard to those things, we better be willing to listen to others very, very carefully to make sure that even though it's not religious, there's not something similar going on, like a persecution of somebody for their comprehensive doctrine. So I agree with you that that's a big problem to be watched out for, and that he was probably not sufficiently sensitive to that. But then I think he also does hold, and here I do agree with him, that we can find a basis for a political state, some basic principles of political morality, on which we can agree and present good arguments that are convincing to people of all comprehensive doctrines, and that's an enterprise that probably has to be engaged at a high level of abstraction, and then we might make mistakes when we try to apply it to more concrete instances, but at least that far we can go and say what the moral shape of our state is, and then we might even use those insights to overturn some of the laws. I mean, sodomy laws would run afoul of a notion of perhaps equal respect for conscience. Okay, let's see. Others.
Hi. Well, this is Sun. Mark Hopwood, philosophy student. So this is kind of on a similar theme to that last question. I was interested in the first difference you drew between Locke and Williams, where you quoted Williams approvingly as thinking that liberty and equality were naturally going to be threatened by a religious establishment. And I wondered whether the problem that Williams was seeing was religious establishments per se, or a kind of pernicious orthodoxy, which could be produced by, one might think, by a secular establishment just as well as a religious one. I mean, this comes from someone living in a country with an established church. Certainly, I have Muslim friends who I think might say that it's at least not obvious to them that a secular state is likely to protect their liberty and equality better than a Christian one. So I wondered if you could say more about that issue.
Okay, first of all, of course, a secular state can go wrong, and it can impose an orthodoxy, and of course, we see this in Marxian regimes all over the world. So I don't doubt that. But I guess a lot depends on how much importance one attaches to the symbolic domain, because I think a lot of Europeans find it weird that Americans are so concerned about statements of standing, that they make such a big deal over, let's say, a public display that has a certain character. And they would say, well, so long as liberty is not really threatened, and so long as there's this kind of benign establishment, as of course you do have in Britain and many other European countries, well, then that might be perfectly fine. But see, the way the Americans thought, and I mean, Madison articulated this, I think, very, very well in the Memorial and Remonstrance, is that what he was talking about in attacking the Virginia assessment was a policy that was so benign that it was, you would have regarded it as totally unexceptionable. Namely, they were going to tax all citizens of Virginia for the support of the established Anglican Church, but if you had some other religion, you could divert your tax payments to that religion, and if you were a Quaker or a Mennonite, you didn't have to pay at all. Okay, so it was a very benign policy. Nonetheless, he thought that just by making the statement that the Anglican Church is the official church, it's the Orthodox one, they were creating an in-group and an out-group, basically, and saying that we don't all enter the public square on equal conditions. Now, you know, some people who write on this do poo-poo that excessive sensitivity to the symbolic domain, but I guess I don't, because I do think that there's an injury to equal self-respect that consists in, again and again, seeing these images that denigrate you. And I have to say, you know, the long periods of time I've spent in Britain, I felt Jews aren't really fully equal in Britain because there's so much in the texture of public life that makes a statement that this is a Christian nation. And I mean, I've got to do something to you and your feeling about your citizenship. And even if it doesn't do it subjectively because you've become inured to that, nonetheless, it's something we ought to attend to and worry about, I think. Yes, back there.
First of all, thank you for your comments. They were very enlightening. My name is Julius Rhodes. I'm a doctoral candidate in philosophy at Loyola University. Oh. And I wanted to maybe take a little bit of a different approach or get your thoughts on this issue relative to Williams, his discussion around minority, majority rights, religious exception, and what is now, or what you refer to as the issue of accommodations. When I think about the issue of disability rights, I sometimes feel as though individuals who are disabled in some way are not even looked upon as a minority, as maybe some other marginalized group. I'd like to get your feelings on where you think Williams would be on the discussion relative to disability rights.
Well, it's sort of, first of all, thank you for coming all the way down here for the lecture. I have written extensively on disability rights in Frontiers of Justice, but it's a little hard to connect to Williams because he's so obsessive about this one issue of religious toleration, and he's not particularly interested in other, well, he was certainly interested in anti-slavery legislation too, and he was interested in ethnic and racial fairness, but I have no memory of anything he ever said with regard to disability except his own arthritis. I mean, that was the reference to the winter snow, which he feels yet 35 years later. The interesting thing is that in those times, because medical science had not progressed very far, in a way, disability was more integrated into society than it was at a later date. I think Foucault is right about that. That is to say that, you know, if you read 19th century novels, even Wilkie Collins, for example, there are people with mental disabilities, and then Dickens's David Copperfield, people with mental disabilities even who are fully integrated into both families and societies. They're not warehoused in institutions. And it was only with the advent of these allegedly benign institutions that category began to be created. And you, instead of having, you know, Mr. Dick, who's a member of your family in David Copperfield, you would have a mongoloid idiot. You know, so people would lose their proper names and they would become warehoused in these categories. So I think that Williams, in a way, lives before the most awful phase of the problem of disability gets going. But in any case, you know, I think the problem does have big philosophical significance. The significance it had for me in Frontiers of Justice was that we have to challenge the model of political principles as deriving from a social contract between adults who are free, equal, and independent. So, I mean, that's basically where I take that idea, and I think we need a different image for our cooperation as citizens and why we get together. And maybe here we would return to this idea of political love as something that we need to appeal to in order to explain why societies would accept as equals people who are not going to pay their way, to put it in the way of crude political rhetoric, and they won't repay the cost that we are going to have to put in to educate them to reach their full human potential. So I think we do need something that's much more like love in order to motivate people to make that sacrifice, to give a child with Down syndrome a full education that maximizes the potential of that child for life and for citizenship. So.
At this point, we have time for one more question.
No, Arnold, it wasn't Arnold. No, one more. Yes, here. Yeah, I mean, I'll repeat it in case people didn't hear because he didn't have the mic. How would I relate the doctrine of accommodation to the problems with intelligent design? And I do talk about that. That's one of the contemporary problems I address in the last chapter of this book. And, I mean, it's not so much, I guess legally, it comes not under the free exercise clause so much as under the establishment clause. And so the problem that it raises is that to teach intelligent design, not to teach it as history. I mean, I think we could perfectly well teach it as part of comparative religion or the history of religion, but to teach it as science is to make a statement, I believe, that establishes one sectarian religious doctrine as in a way that demotes others. So I think it is right that the court has repeatedly found these various attempts, like creation science and so on, to be unconstitutional on Establishment Clause grounds. And most recently, the intelligent design has not reached the Supreme Court yet, but the Dover, Pennsylvania case, we had a wonderful opinion where the judge there really went to town and made all the theoretical arguments, both the legal arguments, the scientific arguments, and even the philosophical arguments, he worked out extremely nicely. So I think that he gave a good basis for our future opinions in this area, just thinking about what might be wrong with teaching that as the scientific truth. Okay, so I guess that has to be the last question. So thank you all.